I'd like to introduce the speaker, Peter.
My name is Peter, I'm a recovered alcoholic. Grateful to be alive and sober and part of a sacred place called Alcoholics Anonymous, and congratulate all the celebrants and including the folks getting a white chip in 30 days and 60 days and 90 days, etc. It's the beginning of a long journey, hopefully, one that we don't have to repeat. Many of us don't make it back. One of the things I learned about alcoholism is, after all these years, is I got a pretty good understanding of what my alcoholism looks like, what alcoholism sounds like, as well as others. But do I really know how deep this thing runs, how tricky it is, how subtle it is, the depths of alcoholism, how it can still operate while I'm sober, while we're sober, how it can still think for me, how it can still push back when suggestions are given to us to get better and we think we're okay, how we can do things that really aren't spiritual, but we make them spiritual and believe it's God's will when she or he's just God's will number one, then there's he or she's God's will number two, and so on and so forth. And we do things like this. But we're not drinking, so we tend to believe. I tend to believe, well, I'm sober, so it must be good. And alcoholism not only works on me when I'm drinking, but really takes over when I'm not drinking. And that's why I need spiritual muscles. I think I said last week, when God calls me home, I want to die with alcoholism, not from alcoholism. And the things Alcoholics Anonymous asked me to do is a huge contrast from what alcoholism demands that I do. AA suggests I do things. You know, here are the steps we took, which is suggested as a program of recovery. And they asked me to do some steps, they asked me to do service, etc. But alcoholism demands that I do things, and I always do them, even when I don't want to. So June 23rd, 1988 was my separation from alcohol, and I get to be a day at a time a recovered member of the Sacred Fellowship. And I've also said the way I'm recovered today, I can quickly get unrecovered, because that's alcoholism. And once I think I've gotten my recovery, once I think I've gotten spiritual, I've just lost it. I've begun to lose it. And so it's a chopping wood and carrying wood. It's a journey. Very often, the journey is where I awaken, no destination. And if you want to know what my belief systems are, you take a look at my actions. Listen to the words. Who am I staying with? And how teachable am I still after almost 30 years sober? I can't rely on yesterday's recovery to keep me sober today. That's gone. I didn't use yesterday's booze to get me drunk today. So it's a daily reprieve, which is a stay of execution, that hinges on my relationship with God. And that's alcoholism. And if I think it's less than that, if I think it isn't that kind of power, that kind of devastation that it can bring to me, well, then I'm probably in for a rude awakening. I would hear when I was new speakers get up to the podium and just shout about this big book, the importance of doing steps. And what I thought was the rigidity in their life. It was just discipline. And I said, wow, how do you get there? And when I was still drinking, I said, it's like a little extreme. And if you're sitting here feeling what I'm saying is a little extreme, I hope you find out it's not extreme, not by way of getting drunk. Because one of the questions that was asked of me, with every sponsor I had, is, am I willing to go to any lengths to get recovered? And I said yes. And very often I wish I wouldn't have said that, because they gave me a lot of extremes to go to, any lengths to go to. And that's something we have to look in the mirror and ask ourselves, and am I willing to do anything to get better? And when I start to negotiate and waver on that, that's a clear-cut no. And who wins is my alcoholism, and I speak for myself. So whatever come down the pike, per the suggestion of my sponsor, or sometimes a support group, I need to listen to. And very often, if it's come from my sponsor, I need to do it. And my sponsor doesn't negotiate with me. He just tells me what to do, and I follow directions, because up until now, following a sponsor's directions work. And so step 12 says, having had a spiritual awakening. So they're talking like we've had it. By the time I get to step 12, my book is telling me, my big book is telling me, we've had this spiritual awakening. And when we go through the steps, we'll see it's pretty much presented to us in a nice package in step 10. When it says we've entered the world of the spirit, I don't get room, free room and board. I need to continue to grow in understanding and effectiveness. Some of us will experience this transformation sooner, because when we study the steps, you'll see the promises during the steps. We talk a lot about the ninth step promises. There's promises throughout the book, throughout the steps. And some of us will get rocketed somewhere in there and have this personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism. Now, alcoholism doesn't care how much I quote this book and quote scripture. Usually, we're doing a lot of quoting, it's for self-glorification anyway. But I need to take some action to be rid of me, to be rid of my alcoholism. And when I feel like there's nothing left, and I don't even know who I am anymore, I don't know what direction I'm going, I don't know which end is up, that's usually the best place for me to be, because that's when growth can begin. There's a story, there's a book called The Soul of Sponsorship by Father Ed Dowling, who, for the most part, if my memory serves me correct, help Bill do the 12 and 12. Bill would send them drafts of it, and he would tweak it a little bit. And he was also pretty much Bill Wilson's spiritual advisor / sponsor. And there's a story in there. And it just gives shouts the importance of sponsorship. And when you're really in the trials and low spots that our big book talks about, we're going to have. There's certain trials and low spots ahead that working with another drunk will somehow get us out of our own way. And the story is Bill Wilson's in New York at the 24th Street Clubhouse. Bill Wilson has 5 years sober. And at this point, Bill Wilson's completely untreated. He's been out promoting AA and doing the deal. And at this point, he's so untreated that there are people in AA who think he's drinking. He's suffering from depression, and depression back then was treated different than the way it is now. We have lots of medication and things like that to help, but Bill didn't have that opportunity. He was living with Lois Wilson, his wife, in the back of the 24th Street Clubhouse. He's the co-founder of this fellowship, living in the back of the 12-step house. Imagine that. There's a room in the back, and the founder of AA is living in the back room somewhere. And their clothes were in like old-fashioned wooden milk cartons. They had nails in the wall that was their hangers for their clothes. And they were flat broke. The co-founder. That would make anyone kind of not feel bright and cheery. And here he was. And it was a cold November day, cold, rainy, ugly November day. And he's sitting up there. And he's in the depths of despair. And one of the fellows who worked in the 24th Street Clubhouse said, someone's here, wants to see you. I think it's a drunk or something to that effect. And Bill does this. And if we're around a little while, you've always had this moment. When the phone rings, you say, I can't take one more call. I don't want to hear one more inventory. I'm going to explode. Would somebody just call me and say, are you having a good day today? It's another sponsee, just more inventory. And that's how Bill was thinking. But what does Bill do? Like we all do, take the phone call. He said, send him up. And he hears this gentleman kind of hobbling. Father Ed Dowling had horrific arthritis, and he walked with the cane, which Marion got to see when she went up to Stepping Stones. They had the cane on display that belonged to Father Ed Dowling. It's like looking at Mickey Mantle's baseball bat. And here comes this drunk clopping along. And he sits down next to Bill Wilson, and Bill Wilson's life changed again in this moment. Father Ed Dowling had these big crystal blue eyes, and he sat down with Bill. And he began to talk about the movement that was going on and a few other things. And he looked at Bill, and he knew Bill was not okay, just by looking at the eyes. And if you're around a little while, you can look at somebody, and they can tell you you're okay, and you know they're not okay. And he began to talk to Bill. And what Bill did, and obviously paraphrasing it, Bill, what we used to call, anteed up. Bill told all his resentments, all his fears, what he was going through. And I can almost hear the conversation. Father Ed, I invented this place. Me and Dr. Bob, I'm flat broke. I'm living in the back of this dump. and I have no financial promises coming to me. And my wife is working in a department store, busting her butt. How did this happen? And Father begins to talk to him. What happened to Bill, he had the pilot light turned back on again. And Bill went out and kept doing what he was doing. He dealt with depression. He dealt with, he died of emphysema. He couldn't get off cigarettes. But Bill went out there and did what he was told to do by God. And that's why we're here today. If Bill didn't have that movement in him from God to go heal one more, he thought it was a drunk coming up the steps, not a priest. He thought it was a drunk coming in up the steps. If he didn't have that calling to talk to one more drunk and heal one more inventory, I don't know if we would be here, and I don't know if Bill would have gotten drunk. And part of step 12 was about where my chest is shaking thinking about Bill Wilson doing this and how blessed we are, how blessed I am to be a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. One of the reasons why I try my best every day to bring dignity to Alcoholics Anonymous, because it is my house. This is it. And when I get to touch how deep my alcoholism runs and not even be able to really scoot up and say, here's my alcoholism in the hole, it scares me. You know, to bring a meeting to Alcoholics Anonymous and get dressed like I'm going to church, not to commit a felony as soon as the meeting's over. And to put my cell phone down for an hour. Because if I'm texting during an AA meeting, I don't want to be in the AA meeting. You know why? Because there's other things more important going on, which means this is second on the list. And when that happens, I'm getting drunk. And when I think of Bill Wilson, what he was doing, what Dr. Bob was doing, literally going through the streets and pulling drunks off the street and taking them to the house. Because they says, if I can work on this drunk, I stay sober. I don't know if he's going to stay sober, but I need to stay sober. And maybe I can have a miracle happen before me. And that's what they were doing. You know, there was no, I saw the newcomers, the white chippers, getting the meeting book. Now, if you knew, I know you don't get the value of that, because neither did I. But when Bill and Bob started, there was no meeting book because there were no meetings. There were no AA meetings. They had the Oxford group they would go to. And then they started the first meeting. And the Oxford group tried to shut it down. They thought it was blasphemy. That's a couple of AA guys were leaving the Oxford group and starting this AA meeting. Like, what are you doing? You can't do this. They try to rough up Clarence Snyder, who really formalized sponsorship, by the way, when you study our history. But that was it. There was one meeting in Ohio. And then the meeting Bill started in his house became meeting number two. That meeting's still going in Brooklyn, New York. It's called the Brooklyn Group. It's the second oldest meeting on the planet. First one's in Ohio. But that's all they had. So what they do during the week was 12-step people go to hospitals and detox and work on drunks and work on drunks and work on drunks. Go to the detoxes that they just got out of. Hey, I think we found something. Can we talk to some of your drunks? And the nurses are like, is it working on you before you get in there? Because you just left. They did that to Dr. Bob. They were like, Doc, you're out of here 2 months. You're going to talk to some of our clients? He said, I think I have something. Up in Jersey, when you study our history, there was some folks committed, and I can't remember the name of the hospital in Jersey, which has a rich history of AA. Drunks were going to the hospitals in Jersey and talking to drunks that were locked up, put away for good. They weren't getting out. They were medicating them as best they could at the time. And they just deemed them as hopeless, helpless people and just keep them away because when they get out, they're a danger to themselves and others. We call those places treatment centers nowadays. But they were never getting out. And so Bill and Bob and some of the early members says, let us talk to them. Can we do that? And they did. And little by slowly, those drunks who were condemned to, if you will, a padded cell, were let out. They brought this solution. They turned them on to God. And little by slowly, they came out of that fog and he says, someone else gets me. They know me. Like Bob said when he heard Bill Wilson, somebody speaking my language for the first time. And these miracles were happening one after the other, one after the other. I was speaking in Toledo many years ago. And I started reading some history about AA, and there I am reading about, coincidentally, Toledo and some of the stories of a little town like Toledo, the miracles that happened. And when you study AA history, it's all over the place. Because their recovery was that important to them. I hope I never get to a place where I get complacent and take this thing for granted. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of the steps we try to carry this message to other alcoholics. In the third edition, it says, but the basic text, pages 1 to 164, have remained unchanged. This is the AA message. But the basic text, pages 1 to 164, remains unchanged. And in the old third edition, it had a blue and white cover. And when you open it up on the little flap, that's what it said. That was in some instructions for people like me coming in to understand what the message of Alcoholics Anonymous was. Now, we have a lot of things we talk about in AA. We tell a lot of stories from the podium. We share from the floor. But what is the message for folks like us to get better? And that is the message that's laid out in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. Some of my lineage would say that if you're not talking about this book, you're not really talking about Alcoholics Anonymous. You're just having a conversation with people about a lot of things, and we can do that at the diner. But we have a responsibility when we're here, because the white chippers, and they may have 30 white chips in their pocket, need to get a way out of this. That's my responsibility. And we can do what we want. There's no AA police here. But it's a responsibility that I have as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous to share my experience, strength, and hope. And that's not just a drunkalogue. That's a way out. That's why meeting makers don't always make it. Meeting makers can get drunk, and meeting makers can die. And if you're a chronic relapse like I was, you probably did what I did, got drunk on the way to the meeting or got drunk on the way home from the meeting. But I made a meeting. Why am I drunk? Because I have no solution. I don't even know what the problem is, let alone the solution. So we needed to get grounded with that, and we have 43 pages in a book that talk about this and what I'm going to get recovered from, the seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And I'm no brighter than anyone in this room. Trust me, I didn't go to college. I got through high school. But how do I get to do this? Because all it needs is a mustard seed of willingness to move a mountain, and that's what will happen to us. So when I would go to meetings when I was new, there were some speakers I hated, some speakers I loved, some groups I hated, some groups I loved, but it was all important to me. And only because of my bottom, I'm not that good of a guy, did I not sleep during a meeting or text. Well, we didn't have cell phones back then. The elders back then would have gone over to you and pulled the phone out of your hand. I mean, that's the way I was brought up. That's how AA was a little different, and it wasn't that long ago. Some of us got very politically correct and touchy-feely in AA, and we're watching places burn up. So that's what they did. You want what I have to offer? Do what I do. If not, that's cool. You know, we'll go for coffee and everything, but I'm going to talk to you about recovery. And so I clear me out somewhere in there. I start to experience something different, a new set of perceptions and ideas that were given to me by a loving God. And part of my job was, as I was waking up, to go sponsor people. And there's different types of sponsorship I've noticed in AA over the years. You got the hardliners, you got some who are a little softer, you got some who talk a certain way. There's no copyright on how to sponsor. We all do what was given to us. But regardless of my delivery to the men I sponsor, I better be coming out of the book. So when I call my sponsor on Monday nights, that's my call time. I speak to him other times as well. It's just the way I was brought up in this thing. I don't call my sponsor to dump on him. What I do is, when I call my sponsor, I have my big book. I have my inventory book in front of me. And I'm prepared to read the inventory to him. And I usually have some other books we're working with, and I have a Bible close by, because he might go to that at any minute. I'm prepared for that Monday 7 o'clock call. Now, there's times when I might have to call him if I'm hooked with a resentment and it's Tuesday afternoon or Friday morning. And sometimes we'll walk to an inventory together. What happens to some of us, if you're around here a while, you know exactly what I'm talking about. We have folks who you try to discipline them to a spiritual life. My house is like a phone room. Between Marion's phone calls and my phone call, I think you work in like a boiler room somewhere. And we have to really fight to make time for ourselves. And even though we give ourselves to our sponsees, and she's a lot more patient than I am, my guys get a half hour, 45 minutes if needed. She'll be on the phone for a while, and she'll wave, "I'm going to be a while." And I let her be, and she goes with her sponsees. You don't have to all of that. Sometimes you don't get to the phone. You forget to call someone back. You don't give them the answer they want. You know what some of those sponsees do? They go gossiping about you and throw you under a bus because you're not available. Back in the day, they used to call sponsees pigeons. And I asked an old timer why. They says, "What do pigeons do to statues?" So you move on and work with the next one. Part of this passing the message on, which I like to talk about, I'm getting moved to talk about, is a 12-step call. Now, I came in 1988. It wasn't that long ago. But I got the honor of doing 12-step calls on the wet drunk early on. I was home from Minnesota a short time, and I had my first 12-step call. A 12-step call is two drunks or three drunks or four drunks go get the drunk who's drinking or using and try to get them to an AA meeting, and if they need a detox or hospital, get them there. And I was told you never do that alone because you might have two people drinking. And if you're going to a dangerous area, you need some backup and things like that. And so we went and make a call on this guy. We'll call him Joe from South Brooklyn. This guy looked like Christopher Walken. He was a big, tall guy and one of the toughest guys in the neighborhood when he was sober. When he was drunk, you know, a three-year-old can knock him on his butt. He'd get really thin and feeble. And he'd cry a lot, and he'd borrow money, and he'd always get into trouble. And so here we are, we go pay a call on this guy, and we get him. And I'm driving with this old-timer who had the old panel station wagons, if some of you guys remember the old panel station wagons. I'm petrified, I don't know what I'm doing, and he says, "Watch and learn." And we throw this guy in the back seat, and he goes from talking to laughing to crying to wetting himself. And I'm as white as a ghost, and the old timer is going, "Watch and learn, watch and learn." He was unmoved by any of this stuff. And we got him to a place called Coney Island Hospital in Brooklyn, New York. And we took him in, and we dropped him off, and we had some cigarettes for him. And we gave the nurse at the station there some money in case he needed some incidental things like that. And we dropped him off. The next morning I went to work, and Joe was on the corner panhandling. And I thought I failed. And I called my sponsor who knew about this. He says, "Tony, he's here. He's panhandling. What did I do wrong?" He says, "Did you stay sober?" I said, "Yeah." "Were you willing to work with him?" "Yeah, you did nothing wrong. You did your job." And there's been many 12-step calls where I had to go with a few people to the flea bag motel. And when I go on those calls, when we go on those calls, we let who's ever working the front desk know we're from Alcoholics Anonymous. You got a drunk or a dope fiend in one of your rooms. We need to go in. They usually take our ID so we're clear in case the cops come. We don't just go in. And then when we go in, I usually have someone check the bathroom because someone might be hiding. If they can look under the bed in the closets. I don't know what I'm in for. We don't know what we're in for. And I never go do a 12-step call on a woman. I might do the driving, but the ladies are going in because I don't know what I'm in for. You guys, more coffee. And so I've done a bunch of those. And sometimes you get the drunk who's not willing, but the wife is screaming, "Please take him." And sometimes you get the drunk who's willing. I've had drunks curse me out with the most god-awful language. But they went. And I think the toughest part is when the drunk is sick and starts regurgitating on you. For you guys who didn't go to college, that means throwing up on you. It's happened to me. And I had to we had to put this drunk in the shower. I had to strip him down, put him in the shower because he was messy. You didn't get to the bathroom in time. And you got to hose him down. It's icky. It's not a nice job. The cops aren't going to do it. They'll take you to jail. Your therapist is not coming, especially if you don't have insurance. The treatment center is not sending anybody for unless you got insurance or money. Maybe your priest will come or your rabbi. Maybe. I know who will come, us. Because that's why we're working for God. When I go to a meeting, that's easy. Walk into a meeting, have a cup of coffee, listen to a speaker, go to a diner afterwards, get in your own car and drive home. That's a cakewalk. But then you get the call, Joe's drunk, we need to go get him. And there goes the diner, and there goes getting home early. But who else is going to do it? My brother and his ex-wife were over at my house one time, and the Knicks were playing the Pacers back in the day when Pat Riley was running the show. The Knicks were making some noise, and I'm a diehard Knicks fan, and we got like a Super Bowl party going on, and Reggie Miller's beating the hell out of us, and we're watching his game, and the phone rings. And this guy, we call him Louie the Butcher, who's now dead from alcoholism, was passed out on 86th Street and 3rd Avenue in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn. And he says, can you meet us? We need to take Louie the Butcher to the hospital. Now, I didn't want to go. I really didn't want to go. But I went. And I explained to my family what this was about. And he said, you got to go. And I got another day sober out of that. It was that important. Because there's nothing like working with another drunk. Working with another drunk, passing this message on, whether they get it or not, I'm chopping wood and carrying water. And I don't do that. I don't do that great. I never felt like I was a great sponsor. Even now, there's people who just have a knack for sponsoring. I do the best God allows me to do. I still feel like I fall short with that. I don't have the patience to hear nonsense over the phone when you've been presented with the solution. Why are we still negotiating on that? So I have a short fuse with stuff like that. Because people can spend, you know, hours on the phone. I tip my hat to them. I just do it a little bit different the way I was taught to. So we pass this message on. There's a great 12-step call in Vision for You and Alcoholics Number 3, Bill Dotson, who talk about the same call and their different views. Bill and Bob paint a call on Bill Dotson, and Bill Dotson talking about Bill and Bob making a call on him. It's fabulous what goes on. Bill and Bob show up at this hospital to see Bill Dotson, who's an attorney, a good attorney. But when he's drunk, he beats up nurses, he fights. And they got him strapped down. And Bill and Bob walk into this room, and Bill Dotson's in a private room. He's not in the ward with like 8 guys in there. He's in this private room. And usually back in the day, when they put you in a private room, it meant you bought the farm. They were about to give you last rites. And he comes out of this thing saying, who are you two guys? Because they were tall men, you know, pitching them suits and fedoras. They probably look like feds. What did I do now? And who are these guys standing at the foot of my bed? And why am I in a private room? How bad am I? He was petrified. And what they say is, we're giving you treatment for alcoholism. Treatment for alcoholism. And it didn't involve 28 days. It didn't involve Blue Cross and Blue Shield and whatever else is out there. Two drunks standing at the foot of the bed, we're giving you treatment for alcoholism. Beautiful story. And then what they go on to talk to him about is how alcohol deteriorates the body. Talk about the body piece. They talk about the mind piece, and they talk about the spiritual answer they had found and how they applied it to their life. They gave them the threefold problem and the solution. He never heard this before. On the third day, he tells his wife, fetch my clothes, I'm done. Never drank again. Took this solution into his life. That quick. They didn't want to know about his dysfunctional family, his issues, his triggers, and his feelings. They didn't care. I have a drunk dying in front of me. Here's the problem. Here's the solution. Do you want it? He said, yes. Never drank again. That's how simple this message can be. But when my mind and ego gets involved and self-help gets involved, it gets very, very convoluted. It gets very, very tricky. I remember going to a meeting one time. I had just moved down here, and a buddy of mine took me to a meeting way, way west of here, and it was a beginner's meeting. And the speaker shared, and it went around the room on giving suggestions to the beginners on how to stay sober. And there were about 10 people who shared 10 different ways to stay sober. And I said to myself, if I was new, who do you choose? Door number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. But not one said, get a sponsor and go through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if I'm a real alcoholic, the one on page 21, that is the only solution for me. They talk about practicing these principles in all my affairs, and I really pray at this stage of the game I have more principles than affairs. On my own power, I don't know how well I would do with that. I don't have the endurance to last that long. But something happens in here where we principles, practicing spiritual principles, becomes who I be, becomes who we be. We couldn't fathom going that way anymore. Couldn't even fathom leaning into a wind that's not blowing anymore. The same way I try to get to my church service every Sunday, I couldn't fathom missing that for no reason. I travel a lot. Sometimes I come home and I'm tired, or I'm in the air and I'm missing mass, I'm flying. But I wouldn't sit home on a Sunday and say, I'm not going to go. The game's on. I can't fathom living like that. That's just being disciplined to a spiritual life. That's me practicing principles in all my affairs. Me practicing fidelity to God and in my relationship. That's not a conscious thought anymore. It's just the way God has made me. Attending a home group and being part of a home group. And always looking for the newcomer to pass the message on. So that's what I get to do. I don't know if this is interesting anyone. If you're standing up here, it looks like it's boring the hell out of most people. So I want to thank the 12-step house for having me. It's been a great 12 weeks. I really enjoyed myself. Great seeing Jimmy and some of the trusted servants. We had a rough patch a few years ago, and some of the members here have great integrity and approach me. And, here we are. And so I want to thank the group members here for doing that and showing signs of recovery and wanting to offer an olive branch. And it really, because I know I saw a few of you here, it meant a lot to my heart. And I mean that sincerely, a whole bunch. I can't walk in that kind of dark anymore. And when people offer that to me, I truly embrace that. Marion knows I'm really a marshmallow underneath all of this. And so I thank all of you for being here. That's all I got. Peace.
Thank you. I'm going to make this go to the next one. Yeah. Good. Yeah.